Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent. We welcome you, whoever you are, wherever you come from, and whomever you love. We extend a special welcome today to those who are with us for the first time, but I don't think we have any first-timers with us this morning. Everyone looks familiar here. This morning, I'm serving as the worship associate. I'm Susan Geckler, and I'm joined in welcoming you today by Cal Fry. He's a paleontologist and computer network administrator at Oberlin College. Cal is well known to many in the congregation as a former member and a regular Summer Institute attendee.
We hallow this time together by kindling the lamp of our heritage. Each of us has cause to think with deep gratitude of those who have lighted the flame within us. Albert Schweitzer. In chapter 65 of the Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu says, "Once upon a time, those who ruled according to the way didn't use it to make people knowing, but to keep them unknowing." People get hard to manage when they know too much. Whoever rules from knowledge is a curse upon the land. Whoever rules from ignorance is a blessing on it. To understand these things is to have a pattern and a model. And to understand the pattern and the model is mysterious power. Mysterious power goes deep. It reaches far. It follows things back, clear back to the great oneness. Some of you may recognize the process I go through here, because I'm never done writing a sermon. There's always another book to read. That caused me trouble in graduate school, too. My message today is the results of some thoughts that I've been kicking around for a couple of years now on the whole question of the foundation of humanist ethics. And then, of course, the most recent book is one that I found from Timothy Ferris, called The Science of Liberty, which is an interesting book on politics and the founding of our country and of some other things. So it was fortuitous that I was asked if I would be interested in coming down on this day and work this together. I'm told that when I was a boy, I was an obnoxious know-it-all. I've also been told that the past tense isn't justified in that sentence. Back then, I read everything I could get my hands on, including two encyclopedias, one end to the other. I would frequently be ridiculed for using large words that I had only seen in print and could not pronounce properly. And I really, really wanted to be Mr. Wizard when I grew up. I was blessed with patient grandparents. My dad's mother was the Universalist who poisoned the Methodism of my youth and fostered, really, my lifelong interest in natural history. My mom's father was a nurseryman who tended his trees in the acres next door to our house down in Wayne County. How I deviled that man. Many times he would drag me back to the house, telling my mom that he'd had enough of me and needed to get some work done. Both my grandparents' houses held delights for young explorers. In a window of the dining room, where it caught the sun most of the day, my grandfather had a radiometer, a little glass bulb, sort of like an oversized light bulb, containing a little whirligig of vanes, colored white on one side and black on the other. And when light struck the radiometer, the vanes would go spinning around faster when the light was brighter. I studied this thing. Grandpa asked me one day if I had figured it out. I was sure I knew how the thing worked, and I talked about photons bouncing off the white panels, driving the vanes with the impact and pushing the thing around. He let me go on for a while until he pointed out that it was actually spinning the opposite direction and that there was something really kind of wrong with my theory. I understood by then the particle theory of light, but I hadn't really gotten into thermodynamics and heat engines and the things that really involved with the mechanism of this little thing. I learned several things that day. One of them, an important one, about certainty, for I was so certain, and doubt. Francis Bacon, one of the first to apply the scientific method, once said, "If a man will begin with certainties, he shall end in doubts. But if he will be content to begin with doubts, he shall end in certainties." Now, I don't pretend to draw any parallels between myself and Francis Bacon or the physicist and Nobel laureate Richard Feynman. But I do find great affinity with Feynman, who expressed his motivation for a lifetime spent in abstruse and theoretical physics as simply the pleasure of finding things out. As I learned that day, though, with the radiometer, real understanding comes from careful observation and questioning what you think you saw. Another of Feynman's definitions of science is the belief in the ignorance of experts. But Feynman himself became one of those experts, not immune from his own ignorance. And no one actually believed in his ignorance more than he himself. He had learned at an early age that it is easiest to fool oneself. To understand these things is to have a pattern and a model. Or as John Hart puts it, the essence of wisdom is to remain suspicious of what you want to be true, and most suspicious of what you most want to be true. The declaration that we honor today holds as axiomatic that the people may alter or abolish a government that denies their human rights. It appeals to evidence that King Charles was guilty of just such conduct, concluding that the colonists were entirely justified in dissolving their political bands with England. This declaration, however, was not the revolutionary thing to come out from those days in meeting houses in New York and Philadelphia. The Constitution of 1787 was a scientific document from the Bacon School. The founders of our country were scientists. Franklin was one of the leading experimentalists of his day. And on this day in 1776, while the debate over the Declaration of Independence wore on in Philadelphia, Thomas Jefferson meticulously recorded the temperature at 6 and 9, at 1 p.m., and at 9 p.m. It reached a comfortable 76 degrees that day. Washington sent rare birds for study to Philadelphia's new Natural History Museum from his estate at Mount Vernon. And once Washington and Thomas Paine went boating after dark on the creek crossing Washington's property in New Jersey, lighting matches to determine whether the water caught fire from petroleum or swamp gas. These were people who took pleasure in finding things out. They had a healthy distrust of experts. This went way beyond the Southern landholders' suspicion of the merchant New Englanders and vice versa. Many of them were doubtful of their own beliefs. And they were embarked on a great project. The French Revolution was driven by philosophy, not really by science. Where Bacon began with uncertainty and was guided by experiment, "I think, therefore I am," Descartes began with first principles and attempted to build his philosophy from there. The most influential philosophers at the time of the French Revolution? Well, probably Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who said, "Let's begin then by laying facts aside." And yet he argued for true ideas of humanity's primordial innocence and the descent into civilization that followed. From such a foundation, the French Revolution quickly became a plague of true believers, imposing virtue from above, forcing the people to be free, whether they wanted it or not. The Americans then in Paris were appalled, and Paine was imprisoned and nearly guillotined just days before Robespierre was brought down himself. What is not surrounded by uncertainty cannot be the truth. Enough of those early Americans understood this to accomplish something novel. Benjamin Franklin addressed the Constitutional Convention on its last day assembled. "I confess that there are several parts of this Constitution which I do not at present approve, but I am not sure I shall ever approve them. For having lived long, I have experienced many instances of being obliged by better information, on fuller consideration, to change opinions, even on important subjects, which I once thought right, but found to be otherwise. It is therefore that the older I grow, the more apt I am to doubt my own judgment, and to pay more respect to the judgment of others. Thus, I consent, sir, to this Constitution, because I expect no better, and because I am not sure that it is not the best."
The stars do shine. Tell me why the eye be twine. Tell me why the skies are blue. And I will tell you just why. God made the stars to shine, because God made the eye be twine, because God made the sky so blue, because God made you is why. Why stars shine, phototropisms, why I be twined, light and reflection, the sky so blue, androgen hormones, here why.
I like to quote Richard Feynman because, you know, in addition to being, you know, an eminent physicist, have a recipient of the Nobel Prize in Physics, he was a character and, you know, a downright likable person. But I was surprised to come across this one that I would share with you this morning. He delivered this in a lecture at the University of Washington in 1963. Where he observed, going off topic a bit, "The government of the United States was developed under the idea that nobody knew how to make a government or how to govern. The result is to invent a system to govern where you don't know how. And the way to arrange it is to permit a system, like we have, wherein new ideas can be developed and tried out and thrown away. The writers of the Constitution knew of the value of doubt. In the age that they lived, for instance, science had already developed far enough to show the possibilities and potentialities that are the result of having uncertainty. The value of having the openness of possibility, isn't it? The fact that you are not sure means that it is possible that there is another way someday. That openness of possibility is an opportunity. Doubt and discussion are essential to progress. The United States government, in that respect, is new. It's modern. It's scientific. It's all messed up, too. Senators sell their votes for a dam in their state, and discussions get all excited, and lobbying replaces the minority's chance to represent itself, and so forth. The government of the United States is not very good, but it, with the possible exception of the government of England, is the greatest government on the earth today. Is the most satisfactory, the most modern, but not very good. And these days, it is especially popular to doubt the institution of our government. But however frustrated I've been with some of those elected to serve in Washington, I've never lost my faith in the fundamental principles and mechanisms of our democracy. Doubt the authorities, doubt yourself, but stop short of cynicism. This is a fine distinction I'm making here. Commonly, doubt and cynicism are used as synonyms, or at least fraternal twins from the family of things to be avoided. No less an orator than our president has disrespected doubt on multiple occasions. For instance, after the Iowa caucus victory, Mr. Obama said, "This was the moment when we finally beat back the politics of fear and doubt and cynicism, the politics where we tear each other down instead of lifting this country up. This was the moment," he said. Then upon accepting the results of the November election, where we are met with cynicism and doubt and those who tell us that we can't, we will respond with that timeless creed that sums up the spirit of a people: yes, we can. To pick another example at random from the world of Google, this time an anonymous blogger asks, "Can truth be discovered by way of doubt and cynicism? Or does that doubt and cynicism prejudice our minds and lead us to project our assumptions onto the text?" But doubt is not the same thing as cynicism. Oddly enough, I find myself agreeing with Ronald Reagan when he doubted the Soviet Union's intentions in reducing nuclear weapons, but did not permit those doubts to stand in the way of reaching an agreement. He trusted their willingness to hold to the agreement as well as our ability to verify their actions followed their words. Not long ago, climatologists, coming closer to my experience, have come under fire over some internal emails that were linked from the Climate Research Unit at the University of East Anglia. This case is somewhat different from other scientific brouhahas, like cold fusion, for example. In the number of researchers in this field is far, far broader, and the nature of the impropriety is less about potential profits than frustration with the public debate outside of the scientific results. To be specific, the University of Pennsylvania investigated one of their faculty members on the basis of emails that were sent to and by Dr. Michael Mann and the Climate Research Unit staff. The commission found no credible evidence Mann or his colleagues at the CRU had falsified or suppressed data. Much emphasis was based on the description of the production of a graph using a statistical trick, which brought data from diverse sources into a single chart in a manner that's easy and clear to understand. This was an unfortunate choice of words, but not a falsehood. This is much the same as my saying that the trick to starting my car is to hold the gas pedal down halfway when you turn the key. Other allegations of wrongdoing include the destruction of emails, that Dr. Mann and his colleagues conspired to suppress publications by others, and that the scientists failed to follow standard procedures of publication and conduct. But as for the emails, they were not deleted, but were actually produced for the commission to review. No evidence was found that any publications were suppressed. Indeed, the privileged information that the CRU discussed was in the form of papers that were already accepted for publication, but had not yet reached print, but were sent by the publishers for review and for comment. The only item the commission found lacking was the nature of the language reflected in those emails associated with such a publicly contentious field as global warming. In other words, Dr. Mann and the scientists at the Climate Research Unit were guilty of poor judgment and bad public relations. But the overall impact of the scientific understanding of climate change is negligible. But why was this problem, in a scientific field, so broadly discussed in the evening news, newspapers, and all over the internet? I think you already know that one. Doubt has given way to cynicism. Cold fusion was initially an experiment performed in a single lab, rushed into print before the results had been replicated by other researchers, and indeed while a second laboratory had already begun to raise doubts on the work. But climate research isn't something you can do in a lab. Cold fusion fit on a tabletop. The climate is on planetary scale. Since we lack a second planet with which to do experiments, we're forced to use huge mathematical models running on supercomputers as substitutes for the Earth's systems. And further, much of our data is historical and must be observed in proxy form. There's no single place on the planet to insert a thermometer to take the global temperature. And no chart exists for the last several centuries, let alone millions of years' worth of recordings. We have local records in preserved ice, or sea sediments, or pollen distribution through the rocks of the Grand Canyon. These proxies have to be interpreted and assembled to give us a picture of the climate. And those obstacles serve to make the science behind climate research more obscure and harder for the public to understand. Believe me, a question as simple as, "When did the dinosaurs live?" is fighting words in some circles. Whether humans are affecting the climate of our planet, and for our better or worse, is a scientific question laden with tremendous political baggage. The virtue of the scientific method lies in the publication of data and results, and the continuous doubt and retesting of those results until a broad consensus is reached. That this is carried out in public is a good thing, but not everyone participating in this particular discussion is playing by the same rules. Michael Mann got into trouble through his understandable frustration in the face of what I would call an unreasoning cynicism. Where the critics are demonstrably wrong is in ascribing dishonest and nefarious motives to Dr. Mann and his colleagues. This is where cynicism leaves doubt in the dust. Cynicism is when doubt goes particularly bad. Honest doubt gives way to dishonest cynicism. The cynic is no longer open to the possibility that his doubts are unfounded. Cynics doubt because they question motives and no longer recognize that sometimes folks advocate genuine truths for partisan motives. They are unable to trust opinions or data other than their own. Their hope is to discredit a few scientists and, by extension, all of climate research. Such political cynicism actually can affect both the left and the right. John Ortberg, Presbyterian pastor in Menlo Park, California, and the author of several books on faith, describes the difference this way. Give a skeptic a hug, and she will doubt that you really mean it. Give a cynic a hug, and he will check his wallet to see if you've picked his pocket. Cynicism is a means of delaying answering the question, perhaps forever. It can so poison a dispute that no resolution may be found. Cynics have gone beyond doubt into that negative form of certainty that is just as much a form of blind faith as can be found in any other believer. Chesterton said one should keep an open mind, but not so open that one's brains fall out. Blind faith of either sort is a form of insecurity. Those that would silence doubt are filled with fear. Their houses are built on shifting sands. But those who fear not doubt and know its use are founded on rock. It is to the wise as a staff to the blind. Doubt is the attendant of truth. We need that living sort of faith, the faith that understands doubt, that goes hand in hand with doubt. Theists and atheists alike have shared this view. C.S. Lewis said, "If ours is an examined faith, we should be unafraid to doubt. If doubt is eventually justified, we were believing what was clearly not worth believing. But if doubt is answered, our faith has grown stronger." And I'm fond of the vignette illustrated by Ruth Gendler when she says, "Faith lives in the same apartment building as doubt." When Faith was out of town visiting her uncle in the hospital, doubt fed the cat and watered the asparagus fern. Faith is comfortable with doubt because she grew up with him. Their mothers are cousins. Faith is not dogmatic about her beliefs like some of her relatives. Her friends fear that Faith is a bit stupid. They whisper that she is naive and she depends on doubt to protect her from the meanness of life. In fact, it is the other way around. It is faith who protects doubt from cynicism. We are where we are because of the actions of our ancestors who came down out of the trees and out of the caves and produced the civilization with which brought us together this morning. We owe those folks a great debt. It's a debt we can never repay directly. We can only pay it forward. It's a debt we owe our children. And though this is not a common word from my lips, I have faith that we can understand this debt, that we do understand this debt. I have faith that most folks are trying to do the best they can for themselves and for others, that most of us can be trusted to do the right thing, even if no one or no God is looking. I'm not so blind as to accept this of everyone, everywhere, all the time. I retain a normal caution, but we don't have to let this become paranoia. I am aware that there are all sorts of people in this world. Some of us have fallen off the edge of doubt and into cynicism. And to those I offer the example of doubt and faith hand in hand. Praveria, no doveria. Verify, but trust. Would the ushers please come forward? If you are proud of this church, become its advocate. If you are concerned for its future, share its message. If its values resonate deep within you, give it a measure of your devotion. This church cannot survive without our faith, our confidence, our enthusiasm. Its destiny, the larger hope, rests in our hands. If you are a visitor with us today, we have a gift for you. Please take a candle from the basket and keep it as a token from us. We will now collect your donations to the continued operation of this church. I'm giving Sam Harris the final thought here today. It must be possible to live ethically, with a genuine concern for the happiness of other sentient beings, without presuming to know things about which we are patently ignorant. We are bound to one another. Our conversation with one another has not reached an end. There need be no scheme of rewards and punishments transcending this life to justify our moral intuitions or to render them effective in guiding our behavior in the world. The only angels we need invoke are those of our better nature, reason, honesty, and love. The only demons we must fear are those that lurk inside every human mind, willful ignorance, hatred, greed, and blind faith. If here you have found freedom, take it with you into the world. Go your ways, knowing not the answers to all things, yet seeking always the answer to one more thing than you know. Go now in peace and unrest. Go and improve the world.